welcome to Comic Talk Today. It is Thursday, May 23rd, 2019. We're doing a different episode today. I had planned something for today, and I decided to move it until next week because I requested some questions, and I got some great questions. I also had some great comments about the past couple of episodes, which have been, I think, a little different than what I've been doing on the podcast for a while. For a while, I was doing a lot of reviews and that kind of thing, and I decided to step back and do kind of what I originally planned on doing for the show and kind of dive a little deeper into the comic book industry and get people to understand some things a little bit better, at least the way that I understand them. Maybe I understand some things wrong, and that's fine. But there's been some great reception for the last couple of episodes. In fact, I think the last episode was the most listened episode that I've ever done. I'm not going to say how many it was, but it was a lot of people listened to the last episode. So we're going to do some follow-up stuff because a lot of you had a lot of really great comments and suggestions and questions on those episodes. So we're going to get right into it. Thank you for everybody that submitted any of these. I don't know if you guys want me to mention your names or not. I should have asked that when I did these questions. But I'm going to read some comments. I'm going to read some questions. If you want me to say who you were, then I will do so on the next episode. But first up, this is in regards to the collecting episode, the state of comic collecting that I did earlier on last week. I agree with 99.5% of it, and the 0.5% that I don't mean nothing anyway. I'm part of a couple speculative Facebook groups, and it's interesting how certain groups approach what you talked about. Most of the ones I'm part of don't try and overinflate prices on their own, but they know these prices are going to rise quickly, so they jump in and buy the books early so they don't overspend. That's why I wanted to make it a point in that episode that there's nothing wrong with speculating. Okay, different people have different ways of making money. Sometimes comics do make you, you know, a couple bucks, maybe to buy some more comics. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But I think you really hit it on the head with what you're saying there, that these groups are not trying to inflate prices on purpose. That is true. They don't do it on purpose. And I want to make it clear that I don't think there are definitely people doing things nefariously. But I don't think that the majority of speculators and collectors do any of this stuff nefariously. I think that's one thing to really keep in mind when we talk about collecting comics and speculating on comics. There's nothing wrong with either of those things. I personally don't speculate. Some of you do, and that's fine. I do collect. And what's kind of irksome is when prices are overly inflated for really no reason. The only reason being that there are people buying tons of copies. And I think that's really unfair for the hobby of comics, right? And sure, life's not fair, whatever. Yeah, I get all that stuff. But there's no reason for why somebody should go out and buy 50 copies of something, right? I have to think about this when I go to cons, right? One thing that I really hate in conventions is when you go and you want to chat with a creator, right? Like, you might go and buy something. Maybe you want to get a book signed. But there are people who go to conventions and purposely bring a long box of, you know, whatever, 50 books of something, 20 books of this other thing, and they want that creator to sign all those books. Now, to me, it's pretty obvious what's being done, right? Like, what are the chances that there's just a creator that you've never met in your life and you want your entire collection signed by them? I mean, sure, there's probably some people that are that way, right? But for the most part, when you see these kind of people, they're not actually there because they love, whatever, George Perez, and they want all those Teen Titans signed, right? They want his entire run signed. That's not really why they're there, right? They want to have these copies signed so they can maybe slab them or just put them on eBay or whatever and make a few bucks out of it. Because the signature would be worth something, right? I think a lot of creators have gotten pretty smart about this. I've seen a lot of signs on tables, for example, like $1 per signature, right? Or, you know, whatever, 50 cents per signature. I've seen a lot of these signs. And it's really smart when they do these because it's kind of a twofold thing, right? So one, you're stopping these people from actually doing this thing, or at least slowing them down, right? Because they're making less money when they try to flip some of these books. But the other thing you're doing is really making more valuable the time for people that aren't there to do that kind of thing. Because when I go to a convention, I want to chat with a creator. Matter of fact, when I was at C2E2, I spent way too much time talking to creators. And maybe it didn't allow me to experience the con fully, to be honest, because I think I did like 6 aisles in Artist Alley. And I don't know how many of you have been to McCormick, but it's a huge place. I did 6 aisles out of like 30 aisles in Artist Alley. I miss talking to a lot of people because the people that I talked to, I was there for like, you know, 20, 30 minutes chatting with them. I didn't want anything signed. I did buy some stuff, not a whole lot. You know, as I mentioned before, I spent way too much money on art and things like that at C2E2 this year. But I want to get to know these creators, right? And I think that's important. I think that's something that sometimes people forget, that creators are people. You know what I mean? Maybe they don't always want to talk about comics. Maybe they want to talk about other stuff. But anyways, going back to this collecting thing, yeah, it's interesting, you know? Like I said, I don't think people are doing things nefariously, but sometimes, you know, when you start buying multiple copies like this, it does inflate the price for everybody else. And maybe you don't care, and maybe that's fine, but I always try to be mindful of what other people want to get in comics as well. I think that's important. I think that's something that we often forget. And something that I'll definitely be talking about on an episode next week. I'll bring this up again later on, but I'll be doing an episode on comic book tribalism. I think that'll be an interesting topic, and maybe one that some of you will not want to listen to, and that's fine. But I think it's something that's important that needs to be discussed, so I'll be doing that. I'm not sure what day it comes out. I think that's going to be out either Tuesday or Friday of next week, or Wednesday or Friday. I don't even know what the schedule is. Wednesday or Saturday. There you go. So next week, the episodes will be Sunday, Wednesday, and Friday. Moving on to the coming of the $5 comic book. There was a lot of comments about that, so I want to get to talk about some of those. $5 a book. I may buy 5 titles a month and wait for them to drop on the appropriate app, which is not good for business, but they would be pricing themselves out of disposable income. If you remember, they did that with New 52, with Batman, Action, and Justice League, all going to $3.99, while the rest stayed at $2.99. Granted, they gave us a backup story in each, but still. Yeah, that's a good point. The backup story is important. I want to get back to that point, because there's a question in here about Hickman and X-Men, and I definitely want to talk about that. And I'll be returning to your comment in that question, so hang on. Great episode of Comics of Today. I like hearing about the value of a dollar, inflation, and comic prices. Well done. I still don't know how I feel, but I know that I have done page counts on War of the Realms at $4.99 for 21 pages of comic. A lot to swallow. I think really that should be the key takeaway from that discussion that I had on that episode. I know I made a lot of different points. I went through some of these specifics on comic pricing and why this is happening. I know that for the most part, people understood what I was trying to say. I think you guys that listen to this podcast are pretty smart. For the most part. Some of you I wonder about, but for the most part, you're all pretty smart, and you kind of understand where I'm coming from on some of these topics. $4.99 for 21 pages is a lot, right? Oftentimes, Marvel does the 32-page counts on their books, so $3.99 might not seem like that bad, to be honest. DC does lower page counts, right? So I think DC, for the most part, is doing 22 pages on their books. And at that $3.99 price, that's a lot to swallow, right? When you go up to $4.99, you're talking like a quarter a page. And that's really, really high. Really high. There was a comment on here that I saw as well about the quality of paper. Matter of fact, let me find it on here. I don't know if I'm supposed to say names. Okay, my bad. Random person. One thing I want is the return, in return for $4.99 is a slight better quality of print version. Marvel books are amazing at the moment, IMO, but the paper quality isn't great for $3.99 per physical copy. DC quality is great at the moment. I think that's actually a really interesting point, and kind of goes hand in hand with the previous one. What I find interesting is I had assumed, and maybe I'm wrong, somebody correct me if I'm wrong, but DC has gone with a cheaper paper, actually. So I find it interesting that you feel like you get better quality. And I do wonder if the reason for that is not so much that the paper is better quality, but because of the type of paper that's being used that just so happens to be a little bit cheaper to print on, it actually makes the comic look better because it makes it feel more like a comic. And let me explain that a little bit. So those of you that have been reading comics for a long time may remember the days before every comic book had a glossy piece of paper inside it. This was the thing, kids. You know, for the longest time, it was just the cheapest, crappiest paper. Maybe not quite newspaper quality paper, but just above that, right? Extremely cheap, disposable paper. And, you know, comics for a long time were colored in a way that made sense for that particular paper. I recommend you go on YouTube and you find Alterna's YouTube channel, because there is actually a discussion about how to properly color for their particular paper, right? They do newsprint, which is obviously very cheap paper. But just because the paper is cheap does not mean that you can't have quality art and quality color and quality inks. Just the way that you do that is very different, right? So those of you that have been reading comics for a long time will remember, when was it, like 95, I believe, when Marvel bought Malibu. And I talked about this a little bit a few months ago when I did an episode on Malibu. But, you know, there were certain studios that were really ahead of the game because their comics looked great, because they had incredible art departments. And I'm not talking about just pencils, but the ink department, the color department, and in particular Malibu. And I think some of the image studios were well known for this as well, like Wildstorm, for example. Fantastic coloring studios. In fact, one of the reasons often stated for why Marvel bought Malibu was that their coloring department was a decade ahead of the time, right? So this is a time when things were beginning to move from print to digital, right? So back in the day, there was no emailing files back and forth, right? Usually you would have, you know, the whole team would be in an office together. It didn't always work out, but when it did, it was great. Right, so the writer would write the story and give the script to the artist. The artist would pencil it and then maybe ink it or give it to an inker. And then it would go to a colorist, and the colorist would actually get markers or pencils or whatever and actually color the pages in. Those would get printed, and then those were used as proofs in order to print the final version of the comic. Once coloring became digital, again, in the early to mid-90s, things were very different. And the way that a comic book was colored was very different. I'll definitely do an episode on the art of coloring a comic, because I think it's absolutely fascinating. And I'm going to make sure I have an actual colorist on the podcast to talk about that stuff with me. It's something that I've been thinking about for a while, and something that I definitely want to do. I have a couple of people in mind that I've already talked to, so it's just a matter of making it make sense and having that discussion. But there's a lot of interesting stuff that goes into making a comic beyond just writing a script and, you know, putting lines on a piece of paper for art. And, you know, I think now comic companies are getting a lot better at crediting colorists and inkers and letterers. Lettering is also another art form that nobody ever talks about. And I've mentioned this before in terms of when you read a review, why most reviews that you read are worthless to read, because they honestly tell you nothing about the comic. All they're doing is relating the story to you. And I understand why that's done, right? I mean, I do it as well, right? Whenever I review comics on, for example, like the Aftershock Central podcast, very rarely do I go in depth into some of that stuff. And part of the reason is the majority of comic book readers are not knowledgeable enough to understand what any of that means and why it matters. And so as a result, we get this into this culture where really it's just about the story, or really it's just about the art. But we forget about all the other elements that make a story important. So I think the cheaper paper that DC has chosen to use actually makes the books look better, look more comic booky. And so I'm assuming this person that left this comment maybe has been reading comics for a lot longer than some folks, and they're used to that kind of thing, and it gives you some sense of nostalgia. So I definitely agree. The paper quality is important, but really it's more of, is the publishing house using the right techniques on that particular piece of paper? And Marvel is using more expensive paper, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the books look better. And I think that's a very important thing to remember. Very important things to remember. Now, you know, 499 for 21 pages, that's extremely high, right? That's when you're looking at the 25 cents per page. And one thing that I've often talked about is, I think part of the reason why we see a decline in sales, aside from, you know, like event fatigue, which I think publishers have gotten better with that and several other things, is the fact that you can get basically any other form of media for cheaper than you can a comic book. Think about this. I can rent a brand new movie, streaming, for example. I mean, you can go to Redbox and get it for like $1.50, right? But I'm talking about on the high end. If I get a streaming copy of a movie, like Aquaman, for example, I just watched that, what, a week ago, 2 weeks ago? I think it was like $4.99, $5.99 for a 2.5 hour flick. That's a pretty good, like, price per minute ratio. I'm not going to do the math. I don't care what the math is. But it's like pennies, right? And that's 2.5 hours of entertainment. Now think about how long it takes you to read a comic book. Really, truly think about that. Do you ever spend more than 5 minutes, 10 minutes? I would say 10 minutes is probably an okay time, right? But you can probably read most comic books in 5 minutes. And you know, I often like to think about things in how much they're worth to me per hour, right? That's usually how I tend to decide whether something is worth my doing, okay? I think when with Nick, I talked about this once when we started using a guy to come in and cut our grass, right? So he charges me $40 to cut the grass. Okay. I have almost an acre of land. So it takes him not very long, right? He's got to ride a lawnmower. So $40 for him, it probably takes him an hour and a half to do the whole thing. That's a pretty good, you know, dollar per hour pay, I guess, to cut the grass. But would that be worth it for me, right? I mean, I would have to buy a riding lawnmower, and then I would take the time to do this every week. And quite honestly, it would end up costing me a lot more than $40 to cut my grass. So it just makes sense for me to just have him do it, right? Same thing with the comics, right? A lot of people feel like, well, why would I spend, and this has been going on for years, right? So why would I spend $2.50 or $2.99 or $3.99 for a comic book to get 5 minutes of entertainment, and then it goes in a bag with a board in a box? Maybe. I mean, you maybe just throw them away, or maybe you give them to your friends, whatever you do. But I think most people would just put them in a bag, put them in a box. 5 minutes of, or 5 minutes of your time for $3.99 doesn't seem like a good entertainment value, right? And I think people often think about these kind of things. I mean, you can just go on YouTube and have somebody read the book for you for free. Some people are okay with that kind of stuff, right? Now, those people are probably not hardcore readers. They're definitely not collectors. I would assume they're also not speculators. But even just for the average comic book reader, I don't think most people do that kind of thing. So that's a problem. So there's got to be a way to do that. And again, I'm going to get to that when we start talking about Hickman. Next comment is, if they want to charge $5 for a book, it better have 100 pages or 10 pages of written novelization at the end, like the Conan titles. You can get more bang for your buck with a novel instead of this monthly tease that isn't even worth it. I'm sticking with trades only. I don't blame you. I think a lot of people have gone to trades. A lot of people love, for example, Marvel Unlimited or DC Universe. I recommend both of those. If you don't mind waiting 6 months, I would say that's probably the best way to go, right? I mean, you can get both services for less than $15. So for the price of 4 or 5 comics, you can buy basically every comic from Marvel and DC for the past, whatever, 50, 60, 70 years. Almost all of them. That's a pretty damn good deal. That's a great deal. Now you can go to trades, yes. Those will cost you a little bit more. And I'm sure once comics start going to $4.99, those will also go up in price, right? So the price per page ratio will also get worse on those. Think about that kind of thing. With these unlimited reading services, you don't have that. The problem, of course, is then you're only reading Marvel or DC, right? And this kind of exacerbates the problem that I briefly discussed in that episode, is how does this affect some of the indie publishers? And matter of fact, that was one of the questions. Do you think that indie publishers will also go to $4.99? I think with indie, it might be a little bit different, because the people that are reading indie comics don't want just what Marvel and DC are putting out. There are plenty of people that are Marvel exclusive, plenty of people that are DC exclusive, and maybe sometimes other publishers like Valiant, right? There's a lot of Valiant fans that are just reading Valiant. But Valiant's not going to have one of these services, right? Since 2012, they've put out, what, almost 700 comics, I think, 600-700 comics, single issues. That's probably not worth you coming back and paying, you know, $5, $6, $7 a month to read the same 600 comics. Now, could somebody do one of these services that are exclusively made for indie people? Yes. But the problem is you're automatically undercutting what those publishers are trying to do, right? Because the appeal to of an indie publisher is very different than a big two publisher. And I'm including Image at this point, and at one point in time, I would not have included them. I would have put Image in with Marvel and DC as the big three. But Image has changed a lot throughout the years as well. They've gone through many iterations. And with the focus of Image right now, I don't see them as a big type publisher, even though they have a very large market share. But then again, so does, you know, like Dark Horse, for example. And I want you to think about, how many Dark Horse books do you read? Can you name five comics that Dark Horse is putting out? No, but they have a good chunk of the market. I think with Image, you might be able to name some of these, right? But the thing is, those kind of publishers, including Dark Horse and Image, but I'm talking more smaller publishers, like Aftershock or Volt or Black Mask or Lion Forge or Oni, there's no particular incentive for them to create a service where you can go and pay $5, $6 a month and read everything that you want. Because there really is no money there. Because the market at a comic shop is already too small for those companies. I never got a chance to talk about the Lion Forge and Oni Press merger, for example, but this is part of the reason for the merger. The market's shrinking all the time, but the number of comics being put out is growing all the time. Now, what economic sense does that make? If you took this kind of thing into any other aspect of entertainment, or even like retail, for example, it wouldn't work. You would be shut down within months, years if you're lucky. It wouldn't work. A lot of these smaller publishers go on very, very thin margins. They're maybe barely paying people with the number of books that they sell, right? A company like Aftershock's doing, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 copies on their books. You think that's enough to pay all the people involved in the company? And this is somebody like, I don't know, like Brian K. Vaughan, for example. He's got his own studio that he puts out indie stuff on. There's no overhead, right? If he puts out a book, guess who's getting paid? Well, him and his artist and whoever else is working on the book. Much smaller than, you know, even a small company like Aftershock, right? Where you're paying your writer and your artist and your inker and your letterer, maybe a cover artist, definitely an editor. You've got to worry about a CEO, a publisher, marketing people, advertising people. There's a lot that goes into these things, right? Maybe these people have secretaries. Those people got to get paid. Well, where's that money coming from? From the sale of the comics. We have to forget about that in thinking about the economics of a comic book. So no, it doesn't make sense for those smaller publishers to do one of these kind of services. But where does that leave them? Because they still need to make money if they want to continue growing and continue putting out books. And then you need to find different ways of enticing people to buy your books. So for example, Valiant's always been great at doing the variant covers. I would say in many respects, Valiant thrives on variant covers because that means that a comic shop is going to order 100 copies of your 1-in-100 and sell it to somebody for $100. And that pays for the entire order of that issue, right? So for a 1-in-100, you would get one 1-in-100, two 1-in-50s, five 1-in-20s, and then 100 copies of an A and B cover. But all that could be paid off by selling that 1-in-100, okay? That's why I never recommend anybody look at sales numbers. I mean, you can look at them if you want to get kind of an idea of what's selling, what's not, but really it doesn't mean anything. Okay, until we have a way to actually quantify what's being sold at a comic shop, there's no way to know that. And I do wonder, so somebody already messaged me and I saw some screenshots. It looks all right. The new Previews World ordering service that ties into your comic shop and you can place your orders through that. It looks pretty good. I'll be doing an episode on that at some point, maybe in the next few weeks. I'm working with this person. He's been kind enough to share some pictures. So we're gonna kind of do a walkthrough of this thing because I think it looks promising. It looks promising. I've played with like Comic Hub, for example. So it's very similar to that, but this is directly from Diamond. And with that said, it has me curious. Would be able to get some official sales numbers from Diamond once this thing goes live. And then maybe we'll get an actual feel for what's being sold. The problem is, what if it's not as good as the sales charts that Diamond puts out, that Chromacron publishes on their website? What if it's not as good? Then maybe we'll never see those numbers. So something to think about. But yes, you do need to generate the additional value. And I do like this idea of the 10 pages of written novelization. Again, I will come back to that when we get to Hickman. All right, next question. I already have a tough time getting all the books I want at the current price, but if books do jump to $4.99, what do you think publishers could do to keep people from simply switching to trades? So this is a tough question, right? And if I had the answer, then I would create my own comic book company, and I would do those things and make gazillions of dollars. But unfortunately, I don't have those answers, and really, nobody does. Nobody does. That's why publishers are struggling. I do like this idea of the additional content. I think the additional content really is the key to continuing to sell at a higher price point. There have been publishers in the past, and again, I'll bring Valiant up because Valiant's always very good at having these initiatives. You know, for a while, Valiant was doing these 40-page books at the standard $3.99 price, and they had a standard, whatever, 20-page story, 22-page story. But then you had back matter, right? You had artist sketches, you had character designs, you have publishing a page or two of the script. That's something that I always find really interesting, right? And I know that I'm a weirdo that likes to know how the sausage is being made, and maybe not every comic book reader cares about how the sausage is being made. But think about the additional value that that's creating just by putting out a reprint of a script page. Because I know, at least for myself, and I'm sure for a lot of you, as comic fans, you've always wanted to write a comic. Well, how do you write a comic if you've never written one? I mean, sure, you can go to, like, Fred Van Lente's website. He's got fantastic stuff on there. You can get scripts from his site to kind of learn how that sausage is made. But think about if this kind of stuff was being put in comics. Or if you're an artist, right, seeing the page breakdown from start to finish of the rough sketch, and the finished pencils, and then the inks on top of that, and then the colors on top of that, and then what the final printed page looks like. That's extremely valuable. Extremely valuable. Because one way to continue this comic book market going is making sure that people are excited and interesting and continuing to do it. This is the reason why a lot in comics changed during, for example, the 80s, and then into the 90s. Because a lot of these guys that had grown up, you know, in the 60s and 70s reading comic books were now old enough that they were like, hey, what do I want to do with my life? I'm gonna work in comics. I'm gonna go work at Marvel. I'm gonna write X-Men. I'm gonna write Spider-Man, Batman, whatever. And they fundamentally changed the way these characters are done, how the stories are told. And think about now, with the access to information that we have, you can literally go on your computer and search basically anything in the world that you want. Absolutely anything. And you can find the answer to that question. Oftentimes for free. You can go to the library, for example, and get anything you want, any information you want for free. That's extremely valuable. And think about if comics gave comic fans a way to learn to create their own stories. Not just trying to figure it out by looking at the pages, by actually showing people how to make comics. How valuable is that? I know you can probably ask 100 people working in the industry, 100 artists, and they'll tell you, well, how do they learn to draw comics? They bought, you know, drawing comics the Marvel way. I guarantee you hundreds of people will probably tell you that answer. So there's many ways to add this additional value, right? The process is interesting because how do you get from one thing to the next? The writer's commentary is really interesting too, right? Not just putting a script on there. But why did the writer make this decision to do something a certain way? Why did the artist choose this panel layout as opposed to that panel layout? Something that's never discussed, why is the lettering choosing this font over that font? Why is different lettering colored different way? All that stuff could be interesting in a way to bring in additional value. There's all kinds of back matter that you can put on there. And back matter is really important. Most people probably never touch the back matter. Because they see just dense writing and they're like, nope, I'm out. I'm just here for the pretty pictures and the word balloons. But for those of you that are into that stuff, think about the amount of value that generates. That in itself might be worth the $4.99. Now, every so often you have a comic that's really popular and publishers do like director's cuts. I love those things. Matter of fact, there's an Incredible Hulk director's cut coming out for issues 1 through 6. That kind of thing is awesome, right? Sure, it doesn't appeal to everybody. Maybe it's more of a niche thing. But it is a way to add this additional value. A company like TKO gives additional value just simply in the way that their books are printed. So yes, you can buy a trade, you can buy single issues, you can get a digital copy. But if you buy the single issues, what do you get? You get this comic folio, right? It's like it looks like you were holding a hardcover. It's a folder, and you open it up, and there's your comics inside it. That's a way to generate additional value. Now, of course, you couldn't do this for every issue, right? Like putting these things in a hard box or whatever. But if you're putting out, you know, Marvel likes to do the $7.99 or $9.99 issue number ones, why not put those out with that kind of thing? How much could that possibly cost to make? 50 cents, a dollar, tops? Think about the amount of value that generates. I guarantee you, if you make your first issue $7.99 and you bring it in this folio, and then the rest of the books come out at $4.99, people won't give a crap. Because they're like, well, I can keep my book nice and neat in this box, and it's awesome, right? You can put it on your shelf. It looks great. That's another way to generate additional value. And of course, you can do, like, the digital codes. What happened to those? Digital codes are one of the greatest things that any publisher could do with their comics. And nobody's doing them. I don't know what the exact deal is that publishers do with Comixology. Frankly, I don't know if I necessarily care. I kind of care, but I really don't. In fact, I thought about trying to dig in a little bit more on that and talking about the economics of Comixology, because I think that's actually pretty fascinating. I've touched upon it a little bit when I've had some interviews on the show, but it costs nothing to have a digital comic, right? I talked about this 2 episodes ago. You can distribute to tens of thousands, millions of people for a penny or two. There's zero cost. So that's one way to generate additional value. Because I guarantee you, a lot of people listening to this at least, and I'm sure a lot of people not listening to this that collect comics on a regular basis, buy comics on a regular basis, would love to have those things, right? Because you buy your comic, you support your shop, you bring it home, you put it in a box, you take your code out, and you read the digital copy. Or maybe you read your print copy, and you put it away, and then you go and put your code in so you have it saved somewhere, right? And the next time you want to read it, maybe you don't want to dig through your boxes, just go and get your digital issue and go that way. There's a ton of ways to add additional value. And there's some ways to not add additional value, right? So I've heard certain publishers with certain books putting out an issue number one in print. That's all you get because the rest of the series comes out in a trade. That's not additional value, right? People don't want that. People either want the singles or the trade or both. But they don't want this, like, mix mash of things. Now, of course, what that does is appeal to the collector and to the speculator. Because number ones always sell, right? It's the tropiest phrase you'll ever hear in comics. Number ones sell. But the rest of them don't. And that's true. Look at the sales, right? You always have, like, a 50% drop from issue 1 and 2. And then maybe another 25% from 2 to 3. And then, you know, it gets a little bit smaller, right? It's like a bell curve. So those are ways to generate the additional value and ways not to do it. So let's get to that question. Do you think Hickman can save the X-Men? That's kind of a loaded question. I don't know if I like the way that you phrased that. We should talk about that. Do I think Hickman can save the X-Men? So first off, I don't think the X-Men need to be saved, okay? I'm going to start off easy. The X-Men don't need to be saved. However, I do think that Hickman is the kind of writer that can propel the X-Men to the place within Marvel Comics that it needs to be. I know that many people have kind of crapped on the past few iterations. You know what? Let's be honest. A lot of people have really crapped on the past 10, 15, 20 years of X-Men. That's real. I know even myself, there's been a lot not to like. I'll just put it that way. But there's also been a lot to like. And that's something that people often forget. And sometimes people forget about just like the fun of comics, right? Because I remember not reading X-Men for years and years and years. And I remember seeing a conversation between a couple friends about Avengers versus X-Men. And I remember seeing the same conversation play out with these same people and a couple of others a few years later with Inhumans versus X-Men. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to pick these up because I don't know what's going on. But I'm curious. Okay, you guys are arguing about this book for whatever reason. Now I'm curious. And I picked it up, and guess what? I loved it. I loved it. In fact, I publicly gushed about it on Twitter, because I really, really loved it. And I understand why many people did not love it, but the problem is oftentimes we have this thought in our head of what we want the comics that we read to be, and those things are not always the way that they are meant to be, because maybe we have this overinflated idea of what it was when we were 10 or 12, and it was the greatest comic book ever because we were 10 or 12, and now we're, 40, 50, maybe older, maybe younger. And we still want it to be that way, right? It's just human nature. There's nothing wrong with that, right? But you need to learn to understand this and be mindful of it. Not enough people are mindful of why they think what they think. They just feel like what they think is correct. But it's human nature. It was your first comic, and you loved it, and you want it to always be that. And you have this false recollection of this happy time from 20, 30 years ago. And that's not the way things are anymore. I challenge anyone listening to this to go back and read some of your favorite comics from when you were a kid, first reading comics. And I want you to get back at me and tell me how many of those comics are still as great as you remember. And I guarantee you the answer will probably be less than 50%, maybe closer to 30%. And maybe there will be things that you forgive the story because you're like, well, that was a different time and that and the other. That's fine. If you want to make excuses, no problem. But think about it without making excuses for the story or for yourself, right? You want to have this mentality, this perfect ideal picture of a certain thing. And we all fall into this trap, right? I've talked about this trap with Batman, and we're going to talk about Batman here in a couple minutes. We all fall into this trap. That's just the way we work as people. And it's fine as long as we're mindful of why we make those statements. And most oftentimes we're not mindful of those things. Again, this will be part of next week's episode where I talk about comic book tribalism. So can Hickman save the X-Men? I mean, maybe. I think Hickman's a very talented writer. He's obviously got some really big ideas. In fact, in the show notes, I'll have two links for stories that came out, I think, today or yesterday. One's an interview. The other one's just kind of a rehash kind of the interview. So read whichever one you want. He kind of talks about what he's trying to do. And one thing that I found, well, a couple of things that I found really interesting is, number one, he says this is not alternate history. And number two, there is no time travel, which is fantastic. Because one thing that X-Men writers have loved to do for decades and decades is bring in alternate history and bring in time travel. And if you were those kind of writers, that's not the meaning to you, because those stories were enjoyable. But if you look at some of these preview images for House of X and Powers of X, there's some characters that look very different, and people are asking questions. And Hickman's answer is, this is all continuity. There's no rewriting history. There's no time travel. This is the way that things are. And I think that's fascinating. The thing that I found the most fascinating is this, and this kind of ties into what I was just talking about. And this is one of the reasons that I'm very excited for Hickman being on X-Men. And again, we don't know what the future plans are, right? Right now, we just have these House of X and Powers of X. I think the rest of the books are going to be announced at San Diego Comic-Con, at least the first wave of books. But this is really interesting, and I think this is how you add value and make people want to buy your book at $4.99. This is kind of a long quote, but I'm going to read it. I don't know if you've been paying attention to what Tom Coker and I have been doing over at Image on the Black Monday Murders. By the way, fantastic book. You should pick it up. But we started experimenting with larger issues at a higher price point. We do an issue with 30 pages of comic art and 20 to 30 pages of data that supports the story, and what we found was, one, it provided a much denser read, there was way more meat on the bone compared to a monthly comic book, and two, because of all the data was interspersed throughout the book, it had an asymmetrical read that changed the normal monthly comic reading rhythms. Anyways, I bring this up because it's what we're doing with House of X and Powers of X. I know for the first issue of both, the solicits say 40 pages at $5.99, but that is incorrect. The books are bigger than that because if we can provide a good value, then it increases our odds that the book will be judged solely on, is it good? And that's a challenge we're eager to undertake. I should probably also note that we're working with designer Tom Moeller on the data pages. Very excited about that. Tom Moeller, by the way, he's freaking brilliant. Moeller's got some serious game. Hickman didn't specify what the data pages for House of X or Powers of X might consist of. And you know what? Who cares? You should probably order this book simply on what I just read. And the reason is, you're going to get your money's worth on this book. Sure, it's $5.99. But think about the amount of work that's being put in this. Not only do you have this 40-page book, but you're going to have this additional material being brought in. And judging from everything that I've seen on what he's trying to do with the X-Men, Marvel's basically let him do whatever he wants to do. And if he's telling you you're going to have all this additional back matter, which I know some of you love the back matter, that is well worth the $5.99. Now, does that mean that you might need to drop another book? Sure. Maybe. I mean, I don't know what your monthly budget on comics is. Again, as I've said before, the majority of you do between 5 and 10 comics a month. So maybe that means you buy 4 to 8 comics a month. Are you okay with that? Well, you should be. Because one of those books might not quite be worth as much as this book to you, right? If the entertainment value that you're getting out of this is much higher, then of course you should get this. The art looks amazing, by the way. Really, really incredible. Pepe Larraz, fantastic stuff. I think it's Pepe on one, RB Silva on the other. Just really, really great stuff. I hope that kind of answers your question. I think the way that the question was phrased maybe is a little hyperbolic, but yeah, this definitely has a lot of potential. Read the $4.99 comic episode. What currently running titles would you continue getting after the increase? Are there any books that you would just quit buying? That's tough, and I'm glad you asked it that way, because I think I've had a similar question before, and the question was framed more like, what comics should I be buying? And I'm not here to tell you what you should be buying. You buy what you enjoy. Now, what books would I no doubt continue buying even at $4.99? Well, Incredible Hulk is one of them. The others are probably Action, Superman, Batman. Definitely getting all these X-Men books. That's in terms of big two. Probably Red Hood. I keep doing that. I think the direction is kind of falling off a little bit. It used to be one of my favorite DC books. It's still really great. I don't think it's as good as it was. I think Conan's a great title to pick up. Any of them. Matter of fact, Esad Ribic is doing like a year one Conan. That sounds incredible. And Esad Ribic's art is perfect for Conan. Matter of fact, I think he's done Conan before, right? Somebody tell me. Somebody let me know on Twitter. At Geekvine. Can't wait for that. I think he's writing and drawing, which is crazy. That guy's so talented. In terms of indie books, that's a little tougher, right? Because most of those are not necessarily ongoing titles. A lot of indie books are more miniseries. But I think even at $4.99, I would still buy all of Aftershock. I would continue buying all of Vault. If you're not reading Vault comics, then you're missing out on some of the best books. Same with Aftershock, by the way. These are not just like your typical comics. These are comics for adults, right? Comics that have depth and story and emotion that make you think a lot of times. If you're not that kind of reader, that's fine. Then continue reading, you know, Capes and Cows or whatever it is that you like. But those two publishers put out some really, really good stuff. And Valiant's doing really good stuff right now. There's a lot of publishers doing some really good stuff. You just gotta find those gems, right? You gotta find those gems. I should do an episode on like the art of finding the comics you love. That'd be great. That's tough too, right? Because, you know, tastes change and whatever. Yeah, just find what you like. Find what you really enjoy. What comics can you not pick up 1 month? Final question is, are you going to address the Batman rumors? So I had a follow-up question for this person, because I don't know if they were talking about the Batman casting rumors or the Tom King stuff. And the answer was yes, so I guess that means both of them. And I'm gonna be talking about the Batman casting stuff on that comic tribalism episode. I'm gonna go a little bit more in depth with that. I will say this: Robert Pattinson, I think, has an uphill battle to climb with fans. And not to spoil part of the discussion, but. You know, like they say in Battlestar Galactica, all this has happened before, all this will happen again. Because this has been happening since, you know, Batman 89. So this is nothing new. And then, you know, the movie comes out and people are blown away by a performance. You know, it's happened with Batman 89, with The Dark Knight, with Wonder Woman, Deadpool, all kinds of things. So I say, you know, don't judge until you see it. Because I guarantee you the majority of people complaining about Pattinson being Batman have never seen any of his movies. They just know he was a sparkly vampire in Twilight, and that's all they care about. They probably didn't even see Twilight. Which, by the way, I did not like Twilight. I did see all of them. I was dating a girl at the time that loved Twilight stuff, so I did see all of them. They were fine. If I never have to watch them again, great. However, he's done a lot of really fantastic indie flicks. So I recommend you go on IMDb and you look him up and you find like his last three movies. Fantastic. So my comment to that is wait and see. Until you see the guy in a costume, until you see the guy acting, there's no reason to judge. I mean, that movie came out how long ago? That was like 15 years ago. Are you telling me you were the same person you were 15 years ago? If you have a profession, were you as good at your profession 15 years ago as you are today? Of course not. When you're graduating from high school, are you the same person you were when you were in K-3? Of course not. Don't be silly. Those comments are idiotic. Don't fall into that trap. Anyway, I'll talk more about that on that episode next week. In terms of the Batman rumors, I guess those are no longer rumors. So Tom King's no longer going to be on Batman after issue 85. I don't know what the situation is. It seems pretty hush-hush. I've seen some comments from other folks that seems like maybe some shifty stuff went down. I'm not one to comment. I don't know Tom. I don't know anybody at DC. I just like to talk about comics and I do a podcast. So I don't have a general feeling on that. Those of you that have been listening to the show for a while or listen to other shows that I do know that I have not been a fan of Tom's writing on Batman. I know many of you are gasping right now. I know many of you love that run. That's absolutely fine. Like I always say, you read what you like. And, you know, Batman's been my favorite character for, you know, 25 years and continues to be. And I still buy the book, even though I don't always stay current. But I do believe in supporting it because I really enjoy the character. I don't have anything bad to say, actually. I feel bad. This seems the situation is not a great situation. And I'm curious to see how it's going to play out going forward with his other work, right? He's still DC exclusive. He's got, from my understanding, plenty of other projects he's working on. One thing that I was talking about tonight, I just recorded an episode of Nerdy Legion with Nick Wetmore. Go check that out. Nerdlegion.com, or just, you know, find it on Apple Podcasts or whatever. But one thing that I mentioned to him is, you know, this could just end up being kind of like what happened with Snyder or Grant Morrison, right? Grant Morrison was telling a story, and he was no longer on the book, and then he went and did, you know, Batman and Robin, and you had Batman Inc. And those stories continued, right, based on the stuff that was happening in the main title. When Snyder took over the book, you know, he had a story to tell. And then the direction shifted. I don't know how happy he was with that shift, but the direction shifted and something else was done. If you've never read that book, I'm talking about Bat Bunny, He Who Shall Not Be Named. It was fine. Bat Bunny was fine. And then he went off the book and the book was relaunched and he went to do other things. But Snyder's still telling his story, right? I mean, the stuff he's been doing with, you know, the Dark Metal and all that stuff with Justice League, that continues from what he did when he was on Batman. The Last Night on Earth, his Black Label book with Capullo, that's about to come out. That's a continuation of what he was doing in Batman. So, you know, Tom might just be doing that kind of thing. Maybe DC just doesn't feel like the direction that he planned in the next year or so was what they wanted to follow. And that's their prerogative as the publisher. I did feel bad because the guy was obviously very excited about being on the book for 100 issues, right? He had planned on being there till issue 105, and that's no longer the case. So his story might get cut short. It might get moved somewhere else. You should never harbor bad feelings towards any creator. Because you don't know what the ins and outs of the business are, right? That's one thing to always remember. You can dislike things. Just like you like things, you're allowed to dislike things. You just need to be mindful of how you dislike those things. Again, stay tuned for next week's episode on comic tribalism. There's ways to behave that people often forget. Because people are not mindful of the things that they say, in particular when they're online and they're just, you know, a name in the ether. So am I happy that he's off the book? Why would I be happy? Why would I be happy that the guy is not writing the book anymore? That the guy got fired? I don't know if he got fired. That's the word that I'm using, right? What would I be happy about? What would I be happy about somebody having a tough time? Of course not. Do I look forward to somebody else taking over the book? Sure. But I look forward to people taking over books all the time. It has nothing to do with my personal feelings on how the book has been going, right? So I hope that answers your question on addressing the Batman rumors. I think that's it. This went a lot longer, so thanks to everyone that sent comments and questions. Again, next time, just let me know if I can say your name on the show. Because I don't know, some people are weird about that kind of stuff, right? So I don't know, maybe you don't want to be mentioned. But if you want to get in touch with me, of course, Twitter. That's the place to be, Twitter. Don't get bogged down by hateful Twitter. There's great places on Twitter. You just got to find those great places. And I hope that my account is one of those. So at GeekVine is where you can find me. Of course, you can always email me, yell@comictalk.today. My DMs are open, so feel free to DM me if you don't want to email. But that's it for this episode. Dustin will be back tomorrow with the headlines. I'll be back on Sunday with another episode. Thank you for listening. Catch you on the next one.